Thursday, November 20th, 2014. This is the Hermetic Hour. I'm your host, Poke Runyon. And tonight we have a call-in night for our regular listeners. And our call-in number this evening is 347-857-1830. So, give us a ring and ask about anything we've covered on the air or suggest new topics for us to present. Now, we've been putting out a great deal of interesting magical and occult material lately, and we need to know what you think about it. So, come on, let's hear from you. And we'll try to have our regular guests on. And that's, of course, Fraters Osiris and Heracles and Frater Solomon. And so we want to have a sort of a hermetic chat room. So give us a call in. And now, last week, as you recall, we presented a show on the chakras, yoga chakras in relation to the seven seals of the Book of Revelations. And this show had a record number of listeners. So while we are waiting for you folks to call in here, I'm going to go ahead. We've got the chapter between myself and Frater Solomon. We've got the chapter from for our forthcoming book has just been proofread by Sir Alexandria. And so what I thought I would do, while seeing as how last week's subject was so popular, I just go ahead and I would let you folks kind of you can be the proofreaders on the air here. I'm going to read it and read it over and then we can talk about that and whatever it is you want to discuss when you call in. Hello, John, is that you?
Yes, sir, that's me.
Yeah. Pretty good. You know, I'm having some computer problems with getting the book out, and my old Macintosh is getting kind of weary. I took it down and took it to the shop and had them clean it out, and they told me the reason why it wasn't working so well was the driver was dead. There was a dead spider inside there. And but anyway, we're coming along pretty good with the book, even though we're having computer problems. But how's things going on your end?
You gave us Frater Osiris and I a fourth degree initiation in Atlanta, which was a wonderful experience. And that you gave us the authorization to initiate with a fourth degree initiation to initiate first, second, third, and fourth degree initiations in Austin and in Atlanta. And for people aspiring to wanting to start their own hermitage lodge, you know, having that and that goal in mind, to go and try to do all four degrees to establish a lodge, whether in wherever you're at, in Pennsylvania or Canada or West Virginia or Alabama, wherever you guys are, I thought that first degree, getting all the equipment ready for first degree was a lot of work. And then when I got back home from the fourth degree and I started building the equipment for second degree, I was like, wow, so I've been really busy building equipment for a second degree. There's a lot of stuff. And you know what's really cool though is that I went back and opened up Paul Christian's History and Practice of Magic to reread his Craterapoa in there. There's something about building the equipment tools and experiencing, you know, trying to, as a person that wants to bring other people in to experience, they've experienced, there's something about building the psychic construct of the initiation within you while you're building the equipment and while you're really delving into why you're doing all this, you know? You know what I mean, Pope?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. We were discussing this, that magic, especially building all your tools, your individual equipment and your temple equipment and all of this, is, in a way, it's a kind of a return to childhood. Because when we were kids, you know, we played with toys, and the girls played with dolls, and the boys played with little lead soldiers and whatever, and we had toys and we made up elaborate stories, and you know, when we were children, and it was a very magical time. Well, in a way, magic recaptures that and hopefully recaptures some of that childhood innocence I think part of this, of course, also is that we're magicians. All of us are very, very, very much romantics in the philosophical sense. We're romantics. We believe each magician, I think, believes that he or she has a special destiny. We are destined to pursue this art of ours, and it is, it's an art, and it's a composite. You know, I say it partakes of childhood play, but it also, in an artistic sense, it's like grand opera, because it includes everything. It includes music. It includes drama. It includes artistic sets and settings and costumes and so it is. It's a composite art form, and I think that people who have never built anything in their lives, and when they get into magic, they realize that they are going to have to build things. Okay, we have another call. Who we got on the line? Who's there? Hello? Well, I guess we lost him. No, but what do you
one,
you know?
One thing that I was thinking about when I was going through the Craterapoa and Paul Christian's book was that it gives you this visual of an initiate going through the pyramid mysteries, right? So in Thebes, and you're going through these huge buildings with all these special effects. You have, you know, labyrinths and tunnels and trap doors and mirrors and, you know, demons that are, you know, rope on strings, you know, whatever the, they're, you know, fake, you know, skeletons or whatever come at you in the wall. And
yeah.
And there was a point where, you know, a guy's knocking on a huge door, and he's, and a trap door opens. He has to hold on to the brass knocker or else he falls. He looks down. There's this abyss below him, you know, and this through this trap door. But he doesn't know it. But there's like these sheets underneath, you know, the brass or underneath the trap door that would catch his fall if he fell. And people yeah. at the bottom that would you know take him and you would go through all these initiations and it was all this elaborate experience that people would go through and it was a construct of the Magus's of the time that would like they had this idea of within their minds of the trials and tribulations that you would go through. You go through this shocking experience, and then they would, in this state of receptivity, they would give you this information, like, oh, here's all the tarot cards.
Yeah.
Or whatever. Of course, they didn't have tarot back then, but it was like basically, you know, your hieroglyphs of information that would link you to their language systems and structures and their moral codes and so forth. And you would learn through this, sensory deprivation and shock experience. And then you would go and it would embed all this information within your mind. And so looking at that at the Kratarapoa, you know, as a reconstruction of, you know, 18th, or 19th century reconstruction ideas of what they went through in, you know, 4,000 years ago or whatever. It was still, the way Paul Christian wrote it was a story. And it built up this image in your mind of, like, what these people may have gone through in almost like a storybook tale that's brought you through these experiences to lead you to this information, and then going and constructing the second degree equipment and trying to reconstruct the process that you put people through in your ideas of what a way that we could do the same thing without huge temples, you know, that are built out of stone and granite and everything that we can do in our backyards and in our garages. It's really a wonderful thing because you want to give people the same experience that you had. And so you're building up the construct within your mind of not only what you thought about it, but like ways that I don't have that, but I have this, and maybe I can put this over here. And it constructs itself around the space, and you start creating your own experience. And you're trying to create the experience within yourself in order to give it to somebody else.
Let me comment on what you've already said here a little bit. I was very, very fortunate when I discovered the mirror method, and of course we all know that story. And I was desperately ill and trying to cure myself with hypnosis and managed to discover the facial reflection method for conjuration of visible appearance. And then, you know, I began to teach it to people, and we decided that, and I said, well, we ought to start a magical order. And I got to say, honestly, I got the Golden Dawn, the second edition had just come out, and I got that, and I looked through the Golden Dawn initiations, and I thought they weren't dramatic enough, and they for what we were for what we wanted. And then I remembered that I had read Paul Christian's Initiation into the Pyramids back in 1963, and about 10 years earlier, and I thought, oh my gosh, this initiation in the pyramids, this is what we need to do. So I got another copy. I got another. Yeah, this is dramatic. I mean, this has got ordeals, and it's got your confrontations, and it's got the kind of thing. This is an initiation, and I liked it a lot better than the Golden Dawn's initiation. So that's why, and I got another copy of Paul Christian, and we based it on his version of Krataripoa. And when I say his version of it, is because we all know that Krataripoa has 7 degrees. It has 7 degrees. And Paul Christian took the Krataripoa and condensed all those 7 degrees into one big degree. So that's what we started off with. But John, you know, really, when you get down to it, it's trying to figure out how to make a person kind of imagine like he's in the depths of the Great Pyramid, when actually he's behind the garage or something, you know. And all this can be done. It can be done with drapes and torches and you blindfold them and lead them up to a particular station. And he confronts, Leviathan, the Dragon of Chaos, and he confronts these various challenges and these various tests. This can all be done, like I say, in someone's backyard, in the garage, in the basement, whatever we've done these initiations in several different locations, and it's so much fun getting the equipment together and giving everybody a chance to do a part in the initiation, it's good theater, it's good drama. It's good drama, and it makes a terrific impression on the candidate if it's done correctly. So, this is something that we want to encourage people to get going, get your study groups together, and you get a group together, and you or Frater Osiris or myself, we'll give you an encampment letter and get you started. And then pretty soon you'll be, we already have several encampments around the country. And so this is why magic is fun. Magic is fun. It is fun, and it's a wonderful, wonderful resource. And a wonderful way to exercise your creativity, and in some ways exercise creativity that you never even knew you had.
Well, that's a really good point, because when I started out doing this, I didn't realize I could paint. I didn't realize I could sew. I didn't realize I could do woodwork. And going through and building the equipment, actually, I realized, hey, I can paint. I can construct stuff out of wood. I can, I'm starting to get into, the rituals that you put together, there's all these interesting little details that you put in there that require a certain skill. I mean, just the acting alone brings out dramatic skills. So, I mean, you're learning to orate, you're learning to express yourself in a way that if you're an introvert like I was, you begin to crawl out of your shell, and you begin to, that's one of the great things about the art of magic, not so much the psychicism that so many people attach to it, but the art behind it, is that you are constructing things to achieve these psychic states. The equipment itself brings you to you become an artist. You become a craftsman of many different skills, wouldn't you say?
Oh yeah, this is people discover talents that they never even knew they had, and as we said, and you make your personal magical tools, and just the making of talismans, the creation of talismans, and the drawing of magical kamehas and talismans and sigils and whatever. This in itself is something that you can be proud of, and you keep your magical journals and the whole thing has a very romantic and nostalgic quality to it, so that you're creating a magical personality. And you're becoming a sort of a superhero in your own personal reality, you know, and it is a very, very empowering activity. I think that empowering, and this is, of course, too, why we have our yoga program, where we internalize the tree of life and the angels and the pagan gods and goddesses that are connected to the spheres on the tree of life, so that we have our own gods and goddesses and angels and all living inside us, and this is also a great spiritual resource. You want to talk about that a little bit?
Well, I had a visit by a brother from Liberty Hill Lodge this evening, and I had a really good conversation about this. We're discussing the differences between invocation and evocation, and my thoughts on that was that, you know, when you invoke an angel, you're bringing this informational system, this energetic system, within your sphere or your universe, your magical egg, if you will, of your reality, as becoming a part of you. You're remembering that aspect of yourself through concentrated will, and so you become that what you invoke. Whereas when the difference with the evocation is that you externalize it, and you begin to, instead of becoming it inside you and having it within you, you're bringing it forth and you're externalizing it in your physical reality to look at it and to learn from it in Malkuth. Would you say that's kind of a good description of that?
Yeah, the... Well, evocation and invocation, of course, are the two of the skills and the techniques that we start off with. And we have another caller. Who am I speaking with? Hello, you're on the air. Who do we have on the line? I can hear you. I can hear you breathing, and I can hear you moving around. So, who do we have on the line here? I guess he's gone. Well, Fred Hercules, we're still holding court here. And by the way, you folks, this is the night to call in and ask us questions, and I'm sure that there are people who do want to know, ask us some questions, or should, I would imagine. And our guest call-in number is 347-857-1830. So, you know, pick up your phone and give us a ring and tell us what's on your mind or what's on our mind that you like or don't like or whatever, and we'll just talk to you. Okay, Frater Heracles, I got to tell you, when I got back from Atlanta, do we have somebody else on?
Yeah.
We got, who do we have on the line?
Hey, folks, it's Joe.
Good. Lady Joe Carson, the Avatrix of Feraferia, and welcome back to the Hermetic Hour. And,
well, thank you.
Yeah, good. We were, as you probably have you heard our discussion so far?
Yeah. I was going to make a comment or a question or something.
Yeah. Well, go ahead. Give us.
There's an interesting little discussion in the chat room going on about music, and so the comment was made by Fred Adams at one point that music and religion are pretty much the same thing, which is a kind of an esoteric thing to say. I think many people would have a hard time understanding that, but I just wanted to kind of bring that in there, and then to also kind of leap back a little bit further to another discussion in the chat room. Just if you have comments to make on either of these two topics, that would be great. We brought up that you had been instructed by Lady Astarte directly to set up your temple. Not all of us get that kind of inspiration. Would you care to comment on that?
Well, I would, but I didn't quite understand exactly what you wanted me to comment on. So state it again, and I'll listen more carefully.
Sure, I'll stick with one at a time. It's probably too complicated to try to address two topics because they're quite different. Starting with the most recent, it was we were just discussing in the chat room about that you had kind of a direct, directive from Lady Astarte to start your temple. Is that not correct?
Yes.
Would you care to describe that?
Well, what happened was that... I want to say, Lady Astarte, but let's say the couple, Lord Bao and Lady Astarte, the two of them. What happened was I had that illness and I tried to hypnotize myself out of it and it didn't work but at least I got into a pretty deep state and the course of this. I discovered that the facial reflection in the mirror, the facial reflection distortion method, that the kids call the Bloody Mary thing, that the game that they play on Halloween in the bathroom and the mirror, you know, and all that. That this is the way that you can conjure spirits and ancient entities and all to visible appearance. And in the course of doing this, I brought up both Baal and Astarte, and I had from my reading, I had discovered that both the ancient old horn god Baal and the beautiful goddess Astarte, both of which were, they had a relationship, and they were both demonized first by the rabbis and then by the priests, and they were turned into demons. And so the way I brought them back was to use their demonic sigils that had been assigned to them in the Middle Ages, and brought them both back to visible appearance and where I could speak with them and where they could speak with me, and discovered, of course, that what we had here was the original god of the original goddess from very, very ancient time. They then, once I got to know them, and all they wanted, they actually wanted me to reestablish their religion in modern, you know, and make it work in modern terms. And sure enough, I obliged and started doing research on recreating their seasonal ceremonies for the solstices and the equinoxes. And, well, very, very much influenced, of course, by Fred Adams and Svetlana, you know, right. Periferia, because without their inspiration, I don't think I possibly could have done it without their help. So that's how that came about.
That's a great story. To what degree do you think that the seasonal festivals that you put on now are really similar to what they might have done back then?
I am almost certain that they are not that similar. And in fact, one of my friends, a Hebrew scholar, he said they didn't. In those days, they really didn't have their seasonal festivals keyed to the solar events. They were much more keyed to the actual natural cycles of the area, which did not correspond directly to our solstices and equinoxes.
Well, are you talking about the first rains or that kind of thing?
Yeah, the first rains and the dry season and the first rains after the dry
harvest.
Season of summer and the harvest, their harvest on. Yeah, in fact, their seasonal festivals were probably keyed very much to the ecology of their particular area. However, that said, interestingly enough, Southern California happens to be just about identical as far as the seasons and the rainy season and the dry season and everything, just about identical with Palestine. In fact, it even looks like Palestine on the map. You got the Salton Sea down there, and that's the Dead Sea, you know. And I have to say this, that under the influence of the Egyptians and which eventually became Greco-Egyptian, the Hermetic tradition, the whole occult scene became, including Christianity, which is our cult, the whole occult scene became solarized. Now, exactly when this solarization took place is debatable, but everything, including Judaism, they all got solarized, so that everybody was following pretty much the solar cycle. So consequently, when we come to reconstruct these seasonals for ancient Canaan, to put them in Hermetic, context, we pretty much had to go by the solar, by the solstices and the equinoxes.
And do you think that was because of Egyptian influence?
Originally, yeah, because the Egyptians were solar, and even though they were down in North Africa and it was hotter than the Dickens, they still were essentially solar oriented. Now, you know that in the Middle East, they were actually lunar oriented, more lunar. Both the Jews and the Arabs are more lunar and Venusian oriented than they are solar. Because the sun in many ways in the Near East is the enemy. You know.
Right.
In fact Mote, the Canaanite god of death is equated with the drought in the summertime.
Right.
And drought and dissolution, that is all thou hast in store, you know. Yeah. But Brother Heracles, are you there?
Well, one thing that I really really came to love about the OTA system that he built. Very abstract concepts that are very ceremonial within doors, and took it outdoors into the Hinge. And the Hinge itself is constructed of lunar hinges. So you have the moon on the Hinge itself. So you can, we do all our seasonals out in the Hinge, outside under the stars at night or during the day, depending on how you want to do it. But then I really realized that you could take, if you have the privacy and you want to do it, you could take any of the abstract invocations, evocations, and do it outdoors in the Hinge, and do your talismans out under the stars in the Hinge. And it connects an abstract concept of Kabbalah to nature that is really lacking in ceremonial magic. So that's one of the things I really appreciate what you did.
Well, we owe the Hinge, of course, to Fred Adams and Svetlana, and they did everything they possibly could do outdoors in the Hinge, and for years and years and years we had that Hinge that Fred built out of railroad ties, we had that up in Pasadena, and Fred didn't have room for it where he was at the time. But the outdoor ceremonies are especially related to the seasons are really, really, really effective. And Joe, do you want to talk a little bit about your Hinge up there at Fairfax?
Well, thank you. Yeah, I would love to have that type of wooden Hinge what you have. However, what we happen to have is extremely quick and easy to install, and I must say works quite nicely, which is these basalt columns, which you can get at a local builder's supply. They're 2.5 to maybe less than 3 feet tall, and they can easily be installed. They actually come with little metal protuberances down at the bottom. You just kind of screw them into the ground, so it's like an instant hinge. You know, if you have a sense of how to set up a hinge, know where to put the positions, then it's a real nice method of doing it if you don't have a tremendous amount of time to go out and buy wood and set up a design and all that. I'm sure it's a wonderful thing to do. We just haven't had a chance to do that here. And I'm pretty happy with our little stone hinge. And currently I have a project of painting small designs onto the stones themselves, organic designs and symbols, which I think is nice what you can do that with, obviously, the wooden ones as well. But to me, the total value, I'm going to agree with Frater Heracles here, of being outdoors is that there's really this incredibly strong connection with the elementals that are around you, and all those beings that are sort of out there on the astral sphere, out in the noosphere, you're not separated from them. You're not in this sort of intellectual chamber, and I'm not against intellectual chambers, but it's just so powerful to be outdoors, and I love that part of it, as long as the weather cooperates.
Absolutely. In Texas, we have really crazy weather. They say, like, if if you have nice weather, in Texas, just wait a few minutes.
you never know
what you're gonna get. That actually is an issue about the OTA doing the seasonals outdoors. Depending on where you live, that isn't Southern California, is that you might need to do the seasonals indoors. So having an indoor hinge is important too, because you might you could have a snow dumping on you, or you might have a rains or extreme heat or cold These things happen in Texas, and they happen, you know, especially the extreme cold, especially in northern climates where, you know, there's people in Canada and in Pennsylvania that want to do this. It's not Southern California, so you can't do all the seasonals outside all the time. I don't think you could do bale salmon out in 6 feet of snow. So,
no.
Poke, would you want to?
When we filmed that film up in Chileo.
Oh yeah.
In the middle of winter. Oh good Lord, in the middle of winter. And every time I see that thing, I see my red nose, I get chilled all over again.
Yes, but it makes a great story. And somebody brought a nice little bottle of brandy. That was very popular, if I recall.
Yeah.
Fred insisted on doing it in the right place, and so we had to do it up there in the snow.
Yeah, we did it, and the snow was about ankle deep, as I recall.
Yeah,
and,
yeah, it was snowing while we were there.
I still have
That's
some of
commitment.
Those old blue ropes from that. Yeah.
Uh-huh, right.
What I was going to say, though, for people listening, wondering how to do a hinge without going to all of the trouble that we've gone to. One thing that we were in Austin, Frater Solomon and Sister Rhiannon did moot mass at Mont Sauvat, and I still had the hinge up at Rivendell, and I just wasn't quite up to taking that hinge down and digging up to Mont Sauvat. So what I had him do was take Fred's old stones. You know, Fred had marker stones for the original wood hinge that we had there, and I found them, and we scrubbed them off, and sure enough, they still had the planetary symbols painted on them. So we got a couple more and touched them up, and we used Fred's original marker stones for the hinge, for the moat mass, and that certainly is a way to do it. Go out, you know. I think everybody can go out and drive out in the country and find yourself a creek or something, and get some nice round river rock, and dry it up and paint the planetary symbols on there in color. And that works.
And you know, another thing that Joe was saying a few shows back that really inspired me, Joe, I mean, really inspired me, was that you told me on the air, like, if you go out to a certain distance to a sacred, you know, natural site, and bring stones or any type of element like wood or stone or what have you, plants from the areas around you and bring it to the hinge that you're working in, that creates a vortex for your hinge to increase its radius of magical radius.
Yeah.
When you told me that, I was like, so... We went, I live northwest of Austin, and we went like almost south of Austin to a river that had been dried for a while due to the drought, and we pulled these river stones out, me and Frater Erebus, who's actually living in Michigan now. He's a young lad and grabbed his army backpack and loaded all these huge stones out. I mean, like huge stones. I mean, they were like, you know, 12 inches by 12 inches and put them in his backpack and hauled it out. I was like, you need help with that? And he's like, no, I got it. And he hauled 8 of these stones in his backpack up this cliff, you know,
wow.
From this river thing, and riverbed river thing. Oh my God. But anyway, we brought it back to the temple, and we used that for the indoor hinge, and we'll use it. We used it actually for the moat mass at Soma. We set up these stones out at Soma to do the moat mass, instead of bringing the wood hinge in. Mm-hmm. And but the inspiration is that and of course if you do take something from nature to bring it to your place, there should always be an offering to the spirits of that site to in exchange, I think.
Yes.
So that they're appeased. You know, you're taking something from the spirits of that site for your own personal gain. So there should be an energetic exchange of some kind, of leave something there, wouldn't you say, Joe?
Absolutely. And it can be, if you didn't bring like a little stone or something from your own personal henge, which is great if you plan ahead and do that, because then you set up this vibrant link back and forth, right? But if you didn't bring something and you don't have any milk or honey or anything like that, or even water that you can pour on the ground, because usually that's an accepted offering, you know, something harmless that's like helpful in a way, you can offer a song, you know, or even just a prayer, and, you know, praying for the well-being of the place, then that's a great gift. You know, it doesn't have to be something that you necessarily plan in advance. If you do, great, but, you know, just setting up these links with each of the sacred directions, after a while, your henge can be at the center of this incredible vortex, to use your word, you know, this incredible linkage that goes all the way out to the horizon and beyond, if you've gone that far, or even up to the stars, because you can start working with your hand with the rising and setting points of the different constellations and planets, and then you start having a link in marking them on the edge of your hinge, and then when you have those marks there, your hinge is connected to the stars as well as to the landscape. It can be very powerful.
Absolutely. I mean, we even did that with...
Yeah, Fred used to dance the constellations like a Taoist shaman, and I think we still have that sword of his up over the mantle with all the constellations on it. The whole idea of aligning the hinge with the compass and with the landforms and with the sky and everything else is really the hinge. The hinge is the first temple, as we say in the first degree. The hinge is the first, is the original temple, and be it a stone hinge or wood hinge or whatever, it's an outdoor temple. And it's an outdoor temple under the stars and connected to the landforms. And so, yeah, so it's something that I like to think that I would have somehow or other come up with the outdoor hinge without Fred's influence, but I don't really think so, because Fred, you know, Fred and Svetlana with Farifaria, they tuned up magic with the natural environment to such a degree. I don't think anybody's ever been able to. By the way, while we're mentioning that, we're still trying to get this book out, you know, on yoga, and we do have one. You know, we have Fred's beautiful goddess on the cover, and we're still working on that, and we're still trying to get it out. But Joe, when is your book on Farifaria going to come out?
Well, actually, I've got another 15 copies that are available of the original large 11x14 book. And that's a real limited edition, and there won't be any more of those after those ones go. But I'm working on a second edition. It's a little bit smaller. It's 11x8.5, landscape format, very beautiful. And right now it's looking like probably the mid to end of January. I think that'll be ready. It has to be ready before PantheaCon in February, so that's my absolute deadline. But I'm hoping to get it out mid-January, and I'm working on it like every day. It's a you know, real exciting process for me.
Mom, sounds like me with the yoga book. I had set a deadline. I was going to get it out by the Soma conference, and I missed that. So I'm still working on it. And my old G4 Macintosh is getting tired. And you know, but But anyway,
your idea of the yoga deck, your idea with the yoga deck with accompanying the book is just brilliant. I think it's wonderful that you're creating an OTA Tonka deck to visualize.
It's kind of an OTA Tantric Tarot deck, in a sense. It's not a tarot deck, although it's going to serve. One of the things, it will serve in that sense, because you know the tarot, the way it got sidetracked by the trying to match it up with the Hindu system, the whole thing got sidetracked in that regard, and nobody has ever considered a tarot major trumps relating to the spheres of the Tree of Life. They're all set up on the paths, and you know, so we're gonna have a deck with our tantric yoga psychic centers that are going to be primarily related to the spheres of the Tree of Life, and this will be unique, you can carry the whole yoga system in your shirt pocket.
It reminds me very much of Fred Adams' artwork that you published regarding the artwork he did of the seasonals.
The Nine Royal Passions.
That's right, the Nine Royal Passions. And it's such a beautiful book because, I mean, it gives you... I think you call them tonkas or visual aids to embody the symbolism of the event, and it's such a beautiful book. If people out there haven't heard of this, I would contact Polk. I mean, Joe, do you also
Faria has them and Polk has them. Polk was the one that put that together and made them available originally. So
they are on Amazon now. They are available on Amazon. I know I just sent a couple of them off to Amazon. What you have to do is I don't think you can get them by putting the number 9. I think you have to say 9, N-I-N-E, 9 Royal Passions of the Year. And see if you can find them on Amazon. And they've got them, but they don't seem to know what to do with them. So if you get in there and say 9 Royal Passions of the Year, you might be able to search through Amazon's online catalog and find them.
If you get too frustrated, I guess that we do have them on the Fair Faria site too.
Oh, good.
What I would like to see is during our seasonals for the OTA is to have that displayed at the beginning of the seasonal. I just bought a I'm sorry, I'm stuttering so much. When you call me up about doing the Soma conference, you're like, John, I need a opaque projector. I'm like, okay, I'll get you one. And I had no idea what an opaque projector was, but I did an eBay search and I found this opaque projector. And they basically are, it's a mirror and a bright light that can project a piece of a solid object, like a book or a picture, onto a wall or canvas. And what we could do, as you know, in our I'm just throwing ideas out here. I'm not saying like we should do this or whatever. But creating a large projection of these images onto a canvas and paint them out to have them presented for each OTA seasonal. That I just love those pictures so much. They're so beautiful, and I mean, when did he paint those anyway? I mean, what was the history behind that?
Hey, you talking about the Nine Royal Passions?
Yes, sir.
Yeah. Well, Joe They were originally, let me just say this, and then, Joe, you can talk about it too. Fred was kind of commissioned to do this, I think, by Elysium. Yeah, who was the guy's name in Elysium?
Ed Lang.
Ed Lang, yeah. And this was a sort of a spiritual nudist camp that used to be in Topanga Canyon, where they had a lot of things like that. And Ed Lang actually commissioned Fred to do that, the Nine Royal Passions. I'm sure Fred must have made the original suggestion, but Fred did it, but he was never really happy with it.
Right.
He always thought that he did it. He was racing against the deadline, and he wasn't really happy with it. In fact, I wanted to publish it. I wanted to republish it. Lang's publication came out in 1970, and I wanted to republish it in print. Said no, and he wasn't satisfied with it. And I said, oh, come on, Fred, it's better than you think it is. Well, finally, we finally did manage to get it published. But unfortunately, I think by the time we got it out, he passed on, hadn't he?
I think you're right. Yeah.
Year did he paint those? What year was that?
He probably did most of the work around 1969.
Yeah. But when did Fred? What year did Fred pass on?
Oh, about 2008.
Yeah, 2008.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, we also managed to have that art show of his murals. We still had, and by the way, those murals are in the temple at Mont Sauvat in Pasadena, those murals that we had in the show. And you can see them in our Pathworkings video. Those of you who have our Pathworkings video. And the only way you can get the Pathworkings video is you got to join the associate member program. So that ought to encourage you. Anyway, we're running down toward the hour. Next week, we're going to try to capture a live Martinist. I don't know whether we'll be successful, but we haven't. We're going to capture a live Martinist and be a face of making them talk. until then, thank you, Frater Heracles, and thank you, Lady Joe, and until next week, everybody, good magic, and we'll see you next week. Bye-bye.